Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. We're continuing a conversation with Dr. Jonathan Stapley. We'll talk about the early LDS practice of women laying hands on the sick. We'll also talk about something that was new to me, temple healers. Apparently it was pretty common with some of the pioneer temples. Check out our conversation. I also want to mention that our latest transcript with Dr. Matt Harris is still on sale. Please go to gospeltangents.com/shop to pick up a copy there. Or if you want a paperback copy, it's case sensitive. But here's a short URL, amzn.to/2NDMB. So I know that's a little tricky. So check out our YouTube page if you want to see that link. We'd love to have you check out that transcript with Dr. Matt Harris. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Jonathan Stapley.
Well, yeah, I mean, because what was interesting to me, and I want to make sure I'm clear on this from your book, was the idea that, at least what I gathered, was that anybody, male or female, could have the priesthood, and that the priesthood were the power to do miracles, the power to heal, that women were equally likely to do that.
So I guess I wouldn't use that term.
Okay.
So I'm pretty clear in the book that there's an ecclesiastical priesthood, mm-hmm. that those are offices in the church.
Right.
Women gain ecclesiastical office in Nauvoo with the creation of the Relief Society, but Joseph Smith never integrates that into his ecclesiastical priesthood structures, revealed and kind of crystallized in Kirtland with the publication of 1835 Doctrine and Covenants. But there's no question that men and women have equal access to the power of God. So women are recognized healers. For example, they participate in the healing liturgy. Women perform anointings, and they seal anointings, and they heal the sick, and bless and for comfort. From the earliest days, Joseph Smith says this is, of course, entirely appropriate activity for the Relief Society sisters to participate in, and any women. Every church president after that says it's fine. So this is a manifestation of God's power. I would say that women receive liturgical authority to perform those acts. But Joseph Smith never characterizes that as priesthood. What he does say is that the cosmological priesthood of the temple requires women to exist. So the structure of heaven constructed at the temple altars requires women to exist. And we're familiar with that because we still have the artifacts of that construction in our current liturgy. So we talk about kings and queens, priests and priestesses. Those are terms that are still they're still within our memory. And so that, I would say, is language associated with the cosmological priesthood, but not to the ecclesiastical priesthood, as I frame them in the book.
Okay, so I want to stick with this for just a minute. So, and I don't want to misspeak, and I probably already did, but the idea here is by what power, if it was, and I don't know if I should use the word priesthood, it sounds like you didn't like that, but by what power did women heal?
The power of God.
The power of God.
Right.
And when we talk about priesthood being the power of God, we don't want to...
Well, so that's
it's not
why,
like a transitive property in mathematics where you say this equals this, which equals this.
This is why the 19th century discourse and practice is so confusing to scholars and believers alike. So scholars and believers look at Nauvoo and they have said, this doesn't make any sense. Women, if women are healing, and today women is a priesthood ordinance, if healing is a priesthood ordinance and women were authorized to perform healing ordinances, therefore women must have the priesthood, right? And that what that is presentism, right? That says that the way we talk about things today is historically normative, which is wildly false and creates terrible scholarship and overly politicizes the present, right? Because it's made for decades. It was hard to talk about these ubiquitous and integral aspects of Latter-day Saint history because we didn't have a toolkit to talk about it in a way that didn't threaten the current orthodoxy. And what I hope is, if I may be so bold, is that my book offers a framework to talk about these things in a way that not only doesn't threaten the present, but also allows us to understand the past on its own terms and allows us to empathize and wrap our minds and our arms around our religious and in many cases literal progenitors in a way that validates their experiences while not terrifying our current ecclesiastical leaders.
Okay, so let me see if I can rephrase this in a way that's okay. So in our modern day, we would say that, in fact, I remember as a priest growing up that having the lesson over and over, priesthood is the power to act in the name of God.
Okay.
Okay.
That is a common definition.
Common definition. So what I heard you say was that women in the 1800s especially, but even into the 20th century, healed both men and women, probably more women than men, but it happened with both genders. They healed by the power of God, but it's a mistake to call that priesthood. Is that correct?
Yeah, so using today's definitions to describe historical practice doesn't work.
Okay.
It just doesn't work.
So,
So
it's hard to talk about that.
So it's consequently challenging, right? So, well, then how do we talk about it? If we can't we can't crack open our doctrinal mastery core document or preach my gospel, if I can't use that to understand what was going on, then what do we do? And it's hard work. There is no easy solution. I would argue that, you know, my book is not 800 pages.
I know. I was really happy about that.
So my hope is that it's, look, I understand I am overly verbose. I use too many big words. I'm idiosyncratic in many ways. But I believe the book is accessible enough for those that are interested to kind of work through the key ideas and frameworks.
Okay. So we don't want to call what women did priesthood, but certainly they did heal.
For sure.
You mentioned two things that I thought were really interesting that I didn't really, I hadn't heard very much about, maybe a little bit, was the baptisms for health, as well as you had mentioned something about temple healers.
Yeah.
Could you talk about those two topics?
Yeah, so first off, my initial entree into Mormon history research and writing was in large part due to a collaboration with Chris Wright, Christine L. Wright, who's now at Princeton. We had a series of three articles on the Mormon healing liturgy, and with the ultimate goal to talk about female ritual healing, which we did in a really long article that I'm still very proud of. And in doing that research with Chris, we found all of this great material. In fact, our first paper together was on baptism for health. So most Mormons might be surprised to learn that among the various rituals. So today the healing liturgy is very simple. There is one ritual, or maybe two, depending on how you count. But the healing liturgy historically has been very diverse. There's many rituals that we perform for healing, including a baptism for health, which was first, I mean, there's examples of people being baptized in the Kirtland era and being healed upon their baptism, but an actual healing ritual, a designated ritual, baptism for health, occurs in Nauvoo. It's designed to be, I think, envisioned as part of the temple. So the temple is a place for healing. Specifically, Joseph Smith envisions it as a place where the sick would, come and not only receive an endowment of power and create heaven, but also be physically healed. Baptism for health was an integral piece of that healing liturgy, but it is immediately and ubiquitously performed outside of the temple. So in the rivers and wherever the Latter-day Saints go, from that point forward, baptisms for health are common. And as soon as the temples are built, there are regular days for baptisms for health. So if you're feeling unwell, you could make a pilgrimage to the temple. One of the temple healers could baptize you for your health.
In the temple?
In the temple, and they kept records. In fact, the single most common temple ritual for many years in the 1880s was baptism for health.
Oh,
so
wow.
There was more baptisms for health, for the living. Mm-hmm. I should qualify that. The most common ritual for the living in the temples was baptism for health. Now, associated with that, so baptizers might do baptisms for the dead. They might do baptisms for the living, which were common in the temples until the 20th century. You also had temple healers. So Joseph Smith envisioned the temple as a place for healing, and it stays that way. In all of the pioneer temples, healers are present. The first pioneer temple is the 1877 dedication of St. George. And we have Lucy Bigelow Young, one of Brigham Young's wives at St. George. The people are bringing the sick to the temple, sometimes on beds. And Lucy takes them and heals them in the temple. And you see both of those practices, baptism for health and temple healers, persist until the liturgical reforms of Heber J. Grant in the 1920s. They formalize liturgy across the board, and especially look at the temple liturgy and essentially have a reformation. They shorten it and change the garment of the holy priesthood way. It used to go to your wrist and ankles. They cropped it down. They removed the temple healers. They ended baptism for health. And so there was a focus on streamlining and making accessible the core salvific liturgy of the temple and focusing on those rituals of salvation only. And so baptism for health at that time stops. And obviously there's no more temple healers. Also kind of associated with that is they, at Salt Lake and other temples, they would sell consecrated oil that was consecrated in the temples. So at the temple gate, you could go and purchase a bottle of consecrated oil consecrated in the temples. People sent away to oil consecrated in Manti because they thought it was better.
Wow.
Fun stuff.
Well, that's interesting. Now, did you ever, when people start talking about the temple, sometimes we get a little bit skittish about mm-hmm. what can we talk about? Did you ever feel like that was an issue with writing this book, that you ever had concerns about, treading on sacred ground or sacred speech?
Perhaps a little bit, but not really, because what I'm most interested in this book is what did the rituals do? So there are people, and I'm also somewhat interested in the exact mechanics of what is happening in the temple, what words are said and what actions are done. And that's a really interesting history. But for this book, I'm mostly concerned on what work these rituals did in the lives and of the people that perform them, right? And sometimes a change in word can make a big difference. So, for example, in ordination, changing the way we ordain, the words we use, has a tremendous impact on the construction of priesthood. And I think there are similar changes that have happened in the temple, but for this book and for the purpose of this book, I really didn't feel like I was constrained at all.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Jonathan Stapley. In our next conversation, we'll talk about the LDS term of priestess, which is found in the Doctrine and Covenants. What does that mean exactly, and how would that impact the ordained women movement?
I think there are lots of ways within the Mormon tradition that is faithful to the revelations and our historical development that can involve women more prominently in our ecclesiology and our liturgy than is currently present. I think that's a non-controversial statement to make.
Thank you so much for listening. Make sure that you like our page on facebook.com/gospeltangents. You can subscribe at YouTube at youtube.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at @gospeltangents, as well as make sure that you subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss any of our episodes. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our videos. Thanks again.